You're listening to a download from the outdoorstation.co.uk.
Number 339.
Hello and welcome back to the Outdoor Station on this, remarkably mild February morning 2012. I'm not too sure what the weather is doing at the moment or what it intends to do in the next few weeks, but at the moment it's certainly feeling very, very spring-like. Some of the flowers are starting to emerge, the nights are getting shorter, and I can certainly hear that lovely sound of birdsong first thing in the morning, making you feel like the year is starting to wake up. However, the long-range weather forecast says things could be changing. So, who knows? The weather is its own lord these days. On the last podcast, I mentioned the new Outdoors Station website, which many people have popped along and visited, which I appreciate, and thank you very much indeed for your notes of support and some of the comments that you've been leaving. And also, I hope that you found plenty there of interest. There's the 350-odd programmes, there's a bit of information about each one, and it's also completely searchable now. So what we're trying to do over time is expand the information that's discussed within the podcast in text form and any links, and hopefully it'll help you when you're searching for more information about anything that we might discuss, mention, interview or review, etc., etc. Now, I did make a little bit of a failing last time. There's one area that I forgot to mention, which I've been prompted to do by many listeners. Now, over the last few years, a lot of listeners, particularly overseas, have been most disappointed that they couldn't make some kind of contribution towards the running costs of the station, which was a very generous offer, but it was something that I hadn't really considered or even thought about trying to incorporate. So the new website, underneath the advertising and support section, does in fact have a PayPal donate button. And should you feel so inclined and generous and have won the lottery, whatever it might be, and would like to see us do a little bit more or help us along our way, then you can make a donation in any format and in any amount that you wish to do so. And it would be gratefully received. Any contribution and commercial support or financial support is gratefully received. But as a result, I think it's only fair that I take a leaf out of Adam Curry's book. Now, he was doing this some time ago, and for everybody that contributed and made an amount or two or whatever, he then announced them as executive producers at the end of a number of podcasts to thank for their support. And so I think that's only fair that I should do exactly the same thing. So should you feel the urge and feel particularly generous, then I can guarantee you that you'll get a permanent mention on some of the podcasts, and they will stay there in perpetuity for you to play to your children and your grandchildren, etc., etc., as you've been alleviated to executive producer status. Now, on the commercial front, of course, if you know of anybody or can think of anybody you could suggest might be interested in actually advertising, either within the parameters of the podcast or in some way associated with us, then the details are in fact there with some of the download figures and the sort of things that advertisers want to read and hear about. So please either mention us to them or them to us, and we'll see if we can pursue that, because the running costs of something like this is also broken down on the page and gives you an idea of some of the investment that's made over the last 5 years now, is it? Blimey, 5 years, 2006, 2007, yeah, five years. No, it was 2006 I started, wasn't it? Yeah, so that's 6 years, blimey, that we've been doing this. Anyway, let's move on from that. Now, the other thing that I did mention last time was some of the podcasts that I'd been introduced to via the European Podcast Awards. And I just want to say just how much pleasure that I've been getting going back through the back catalogue of the one I mentioned, podcasts.ie. And in particular, the Calendar Road series produced by Sinead McClure. Now, Sinead has got a wonderful, gentle, slow-pacing Irish lilt. It is gorgeous to listen to. And she just talks about the Calendar Road, which I presume is a road that's a rural road that runs near her. And she talks about wildlife, the gentle pace, the nature, the changing in the environment, as the seasons change, and what's changing you know, what's growing, what's coming through, and some of the sort of local history. And it's a wonderful series, Voices from Ireland series. So look that up if you can. That's podcast.ie, the Calendar Road series. At the moment, it goes back 12 months. She hasn't done one into this year just yet. But when she does, I'm definitely listening to that. That's superb. So thanks to Sinead for taking the time to do those. They're really, really nice. The other one, which I have mentioned before, I think, but I will mention again because, again, I've thoroughly enjoyed it and I do enjoy downloading some of their productions, is The Bike Show. Now, that's produced and released on Resonance FM, which, of course, where David Linton has done some freelance work. Now, David, of course, in some of our previous podcasts, you'll remember that he interviewed Chris Townsend up on the hills, and also I interviewed David when he did his long 500-mile European trip just recently. So it's the same pedigree. It's super, very, very good to listen to, and it's presented by Jack Thurston, and they started in 2004, and it's everything to do with cycling, everything to do with bikes. So it covers a wide gambit. It covers obviously racing and racing personalities. It covers politics. It covers sort of local cycling in rural communities. It covers cycling in London and some of the problems they have there. But they also do a whole series of, or have done over the last few years, a series of interviews with people that have done long-distance cycle trips. And again, that's really, really interesting. Just the same sort of interviews that we do. How did they do it? How did they afford it? What sort of gear did they take? And the impressions that the world has left upon them from their return. And I noticed, in fact, it's just downloading at the moment. The latest release is an interview with Andrew Sykes, who did a six-week summer journey from his home in Berkshire to South Italy in Puglia, in South Italy. And I'm looking forward to listening to that. Which leads us on nicely to the interview today. Now, this is the first part of a two-part series where I speak to Warren and Esther Sanders, who are at the moment cycling around the world. It's a lovely idea, isn't it? It's great to escape the idea of doing that. And they've decided to pack up and spend 4 years covering most of the world and enjoying the cycle trips. It's not a race. It's not the shortest route. It's definitely a route where they're wanting to enjoy what the environment and the country and the area has to offer them. And they're doing it like most of us would probably want to do it these days, or have to do it, very, very on a very tight budget, keeping life very, very simple. The first year of their trip involved travelling around New Zealand, which is covered in this interview. Part two will cover their trip through America and some of the things they discovered there. I spoke to Warren and Esther in January of 2012, where they were resting up in mainland Europe before tackling the next stage of their trip.
Well, currently, at the moment, we're on a lovely island called Rügen, which is part of Germany, and kind of juts out into the Baltic Sea, just at the very point where Germany runs into Poland. It's a former eastern area. This is where Esther's grandparents live and where we store two lovely mountain bikes. Absolutely gorgeous place for cycling, single track.
And as it's the beginning of January 2012, what's the weather conditions like in that part of sunny Europe?
Well, we've had current, as of today, this is the first time we've seen the sun, that wonderful orb in the sky. We've had 2 weeks, 3 weeks of blustery winds and rain. This time last year, there's probably 4 meters of snow here, and the Baltic was frozen. So that was picture postcard perfect. This is cruel and unkind.
Now, for listeners tuning into this interview, I think they should look at your blog as we talk, because it's very, very informative and lots of pictures to add some colour to the content. So if they Google the Sports Wool Diaries, sports plural, Sports Wool Diaries, they will pick up on estherwarren.wordpress.com, which contains all the background information of the story that's about to unfold. But would you just like to just give me a bit of an overview, give us a bit of an overview of the actual trip that you're on and how long you've been doing this now?
Well, we actually started thinking about it probably 10 years ago when I turned 40 and Esther turned 30. And we were sitting in a cafe in Edinburgh and there's a map of France on the wall. And we'd done a little bit of cycle touring, but nothing dramatic. And I thought, 40th birthday, let's cross France. And we got up and had a look at the map, and that's probably about 1,000 miles. And that's what we did. So that was the backbone. And we had absolutely appalling equipment and looked like tramps. But you're still young and supple, so you get away with it.
What led from the trip across France to what is now a world trip?
Start reading travel books, both climbing books and walking books and cycling books. And eventually you think, if I don't get away and do something more ambitious than a three-week tour, I'm going to be physically ill. The wanting to know what's around the corner. Whenever I sat down and watched the Tour de France, one eye was on the landscape. Tour of the Spain, one eye was on the landscape. And Tour of Italy, always thinking that would be an absolutely stunning place to just ride along. And so that kind of longing was there very, very strongly.
Is this a world tour that you're doing of chosen cycle spots that you want to visit, or are you actually cycling around the world?
Yeah, we kind of worked out it, if you wanted to spend time in an area, do things like circles or figures of eight. If you actually rode around the world continuously, you'd always end up in the wrong place at the wrong time, in the wrong season, or against the wind, or in a place that wasn't at its best. So we decided to cherry-pick the world and spend longer times in the countries and fly between them in the first year. But so we did New Zealand figure of eight, 2,600 miles, and then we did the US west coast up to Seattle, and then across coast to coast, which was 7,000 miles or a little more. So that was year one. And looking to go across Europe, basically we got so fed up with trying to get visas for the United States, we vowed in year two we'd have so little to do with the visa applications, and so Europe kind of chose itself for year two, and kind of just putting that together at the moment.
So I'm right in thinking then that we are now at the end of the first year of the big trip, of the travel itself.
Yeah, with 10,000 miles in, road hardened, and waiting now to go down to Portugal, where we'll start to come across Europe as soon, depending on how much snow we've got in the way. This year looks like it's going to be a light snow year, so we can start fairly early on. We want to try and find the same 10,000 miles. So it's Portugal, across Europe, and head up towards somewhere towards the Arctic Circle, through Sweden, then back through Finland and around the Baltic states for this year.
Okay, so to give listeners more of an idea of exactly the way that you're approaching this, you said with your first trip across France you had incorrect equipment for whatever reason. Are you approaching this from a luxury flash packing idea, or is the aspect more of a cost effective, as affordable as you can possibly make it type of trip?
It's as affordable as possible, being self-contained, spending as little money as possible. Now, there will always be periods where you think, oh, my goodness, got to take a hotel room or motel room. And then the next day it's an appalling weather or there's no way to camp. So you take a hotel room, motel, and you think, gosh, this is really starting to add up. But taken long term, You will get a run of 2 weeks where you'll spend absolutely nothing. So we're self-contained. We can camp on people's gardens. We can camp wild. We can go to campsites, or when we have to, we'll go into motels or hotels.
Have you sort of set yourself a daily budget roughly in each area that you visit, that you'll work to? Are you trying to be fairly strict on the funds from that point of view?
We spend as little money as possible without making ourselves ill with the worry of it all. It could be done for less. We that's what we did in the past. You know, having to go into a shop and try and find the largest number of calories for the smallest amount of money possible. Hopefully, at the moment, we things will average out. You always pray that things will average out. You will get meals for free. People will be wonderful to you, and it will average out. We're kind of budgeting £1,000 a month for the two of us. Sometimes it crawls over that if you have a mechanical, or if you have a string of these motel nights. £1,200 is probably getting you. That's pretty good value for two of us.
Yeah, excellent. But it's quite good to have a budget, really, that listeners can relate to understand, you know, the type of style that you're doing this in.
You're listening to theoutdoorstation.co.uk.
Let's first talk about the first year's trip then and the places you've actually been and some of the experiences you've had there before we actually talk about some of the things you've learned about yourself and about the people you've met and travelling in general. Now, I've been to New Zealand. I've been very fortunate to be to New Zealand. I've always described it as the best part of Wales, all scrunched together in a very narrow island. So you can go skiing in the morning and swimming in the sea in the afternoon. How did you find New Zealand as a place, as a cycle destination?
Well, it's considered to be one of the top five destinations in the world. The one of the guidebooks is actually called Peddler's Paradise. It may have been, I think, maybe 10 years ago, 15 years ago. We were looking for a Southern Hemisphere destination setting off in January. And, yeah, New Zealand was a very, very big draw to us. And arriving there in Auckland, straight out of the aircraft into 30-degree heat. And very early on, we realized when we started pedaling there that very little of it is flat. They think absolutely nothing of a 12% gradient to 14% gradient. And the roads are pretty narrow and pretty busy. All the backpackers and people that were on their bikes 10 years ago or more have now converted across to being camper packing, camper van use and small cars. There actually isn't that many people on their bicycles there at the moment, which is a shame. I can see why that is.
I presume you went headed north out of Auckland and went up to the Bay of Islands, which I think is a terrific area and one of the jewels in New Zealand's crown.
Yeah, we set out from Auckland trying to go to the Coromandel Peninsula and actually caught the tail end of a hurricane, so roads washed out in front of us and behind us, and so we had to kind of slightly double back and then head down to the main east coast of the North Island. And to be honest, that is an absolute gem. That was the highlight of the trip, being very, very windy, very difficult terrain for tour parties to get down there. It is very, very much a Maori stronghold all the way down there, and the Maori people were absolutely wonderful to us. That was, if we came away from New Zealand with one thing, it was just the kindness, the wonderful joy of the Maoris to people who were travelling by bicycle.
And so, Esther, what did you think about the cycling experience in New Zealand compared to Germany and Europe? Did you find it was a completely different environment for you, or did you feel fairly comfortable on the road?
I guess there are two sort of images I come back with from New Zealand. Number one is that North Island and South Island are very different in its characters. The North Island, there were quite a lot of areas that I could actually relate to with Europe. There were quite a lot of corners where I said, you know, this looks a bit like home or like Germany, or this looks like the northern German territory, I must say. But the South Island was something that was pretty unexpected. The vegetation was different. the alpine regions there were different, and obviously being surrounded by this big mass of water. And we saw also the glaciers there. So there were so many different things that that you didn't, or that I have never seen in Europe. That was wonderful to see. Again, I probably have to back Warren there that to cycle along there was quite challenging. The hills were quite challenging. The weather was quite challenging in both parts, I must say, even though we were really lucky with the weather. But on the North Island, we had heat waves that I wasn't used to. And then when you have to climb up these hills with your heavy luggage, that was quite difficult. And then on the South Island, you went through actually this beautiful green, lush area. And when we were talking to people, they were saying they had the dreadful summer down on the South Island. And when we arrived there, we had blue skies and went through the Haas Pass down at one of the last passes on the South Island, in blue skies and, you know, with no raindrop. And that was very, very special. So again, both parts, you know, one hand you could relate to it and the other part was outstanding and different.
Well, I admire you cycling up through the Haas Pass because I've been there and it's a heck of a height up there.
Yeah, we had to push.
I'm not surprised. I remember, I don't know if it's still there, but we stayed in the hostel that was there. And the dorms had male and female dorms at the time. And we had, for some reason, we had to get off early in the morning. And I went to find Rose in the women's dorm. And I couldn't find her. All I saw was this pile of blankets. And I couldn't work out where she was. And I realised it wasn't a pile of blankets. It was actually, she was underneath it all. She was freezing cold. But I found the New Zealand, the Kiwis, very interested, very genuine in who we were at the time, although it was some time ago. And I dare say that hasn't changed.
No, I think the problem we kind of had was coming from Scotland, the idea that you can camp anywhere. You really can't do that in New Zealand. Or we'd never felt confident enough. And every time we asked a farmer, just in, you know, in passing, well, they kind of informed us that they shot from the porch and asked questions later. It's a very expensive place to be, in actual fact, because they're trying to push you to be on the campsites. I think in the interior, you'd obviously be able to do wild camping, but
also, if I may talk. May add to this, the camping itself was actually pretty well organized. I guess when you go into the interior and you actually walk there, it would be a different experience from when you're on the bike, because we stayed on the roads. What we got actually with our bikes, or where we got to, is different from when you're walking, The places where we stayed, even though they were, most places fantastically equipped, they were actually still quite expensive. But then again, you know, you have to get over the expensive part and just take what's there and do, you know, with the things you've got in front of you. But because we had to be fairly close to the roads, we were a bit limited compared to when you would walk around there.
I certainly found my time there that the penny suddenly dropped exactly the same way you've just described, that I realised that every inch of New Zealand is owned by somebody, and the public access and rights of way just didn't exist 20, 30 years ago when I was there. Obviously, and that hasn't changed, and as you say, they tend to shoot from the porch is a good description of how they view their land. But what I also found was that you'd get in conversation with a shopkeeper or somebody in the street or in a cafe or whatever, and they would actually invite you back to their... Well, they have the things called sleepouts, which are their sort of huts they have in the garden where their friends or their children or when they have barbecues come and stay. Did you get many people inviting you to do that?
We met at a campsite, a family of farmers. They seem to own quite a percentage of New Zealand, and we realised that we were going past their farm, and Yeah, they invited us back to their one farm, and then their mother and father owned a farm further on, and that was incredible. That was one of the highlights. And there was one day where we just were being blown off the road, and a farmer stopped his truck and said, "You know, that doesn't look like good fun. Do you want to come home and sit this one out and have some food?" So the kindness is there. Not as much as we found in the United States. But I think because there will be another cyclist along in an hour or two, you're not unique in the environment.
With over a million listeners worldwide, The Outdoor Station is the leading online audio resource for those into the great outdoors.
This being the sort of the start of the trip then, and the time it's taken you to travel around New Zealand, how did you find your views on life and the world changing in itself? You've obviously had a cycle experience and life experience, but did you find that there's a change came over you both at all?
I think when you set out and you've given yourself almost an ending time to do this in, the moment you step off the plane, you have this, I don't have to rush. If something nice comes up, this is we can hang around here. We can talk to as many people as we like. There's absolutely no rush, and that took probably 3 or 4 weeks to get used to. It's a very, very nice feeling. Not trying. 'Cause every time we've been on a bike trip before that, it always ends up as a race, and we. Trying very hard not to let that happen.
Not to rush off. And that's, exactly. there's a certain amount of guilt, I assume, that's associated with this feeling as well, realizing that actually you don't have to rush back for anything.
Yeah. Well, the guilt goes away very quickly, Bob.
Oh dear, we're making far too many people envious, I'm sure. So, if there was anything that you would reflect on, I'm looking at your blog posts at the moment about New Zealand. Is there anything that in particular that took you completely by surprise in New Zealand, which you just didn't anticipate at all?
Actually, Esther's just reminded me when we set out, people were wondering how we'd managed to with living together. Absolutely 24/7, and how we would cope with that, and we've absolutely loved it. And the realization that you become a very, very strong team, and to be honest, it's probably 24/6 by the time you add up all the times that you're cycling slightly apart. That is the strongest thing that we found that we could do. In fact, when we first came together. Within a week or two of coming together at our college, we were off traveling, and we've traveled across America with a car, and traveling together as a partnership, it's just a wonderful thing. I'm sure you probably find that yourself.
It certainly makes you realise that you understand each other's good points and bad points very clearly.
Yeah, I think if you've got it just gives you a warm glow even thinking about it. It's so rare, and it works, and you're the same pace, which is very important.
I think my experience in travel generally, and the people I've met who have travelled like yourself, on foot or bicycle or whatever, is that it strips away all the outer layers of life, which we wrap ourselves in domestic environment. So you know the clothes and all the other things that associate yourself with the impression that you might have of yourself disappear, and you know, two people travelling can really get to know each other much more than many years spent together in a domestic environment, I think.
Yeah, a year on the road or even 6 months on the road is worth many, many years in a normal environment. You get to know each other's depth in depth, your strength. And we kind of agreed very early on never to talk about whether we're enjoying it during the first hour of any day. Until your muscles warm up, and because you don't enjoy it for the first hour, and don't start the conversation at all.
Just being sort of slightly technical at the moment to touch on a different area, just looking at New Zealand at the moment rather than going on to America, which we'll do in a second. From an equipment point of view, what did you find that you were missing that you really could have done with? People will see your equipment list on the blog, but is there anything that you thought, well, I really should have taken that, and anything that I did need to take?
The one thing that caught us out with New Zealand was... Now, we're told that they spend, I can't remember the figure, it was either 8 or 18% of their gross national product on the roads. So they're wonderful. They look superb. But boy, are they abrasive. And I started on 28 millimeter tyres on the bike, and they just got ripped apart within 700 miles. I was on the new set of tyres. So that the bad choice there was, you need slightly wider tyres than you would imagine for road cycling. So that's what I should have organised. Best bit of kit. This will sound like Pot Cozy FM, but yeah, it is once again the Pot Cozy.
It's a remarkably simple but effective piece of equipment, isn't it?
Yeah, and then nobody's got them. A number of people said, "Well, where do you get them? How do you buy them?" And you think, "No, you get a kit and you work it out for yourself." You start once you've used a Pot Cozy. And sorry to dwell on Pot Cozies, but when you come indoors, you think, cooking here, I've got this thing on the gas, and it should be in a Pot Cozy indoors.
Yeah, good point, actually. Were you cooking on gas or meths or wood stoves while you were in New Zealand?
The standard stove to use for around the world is a Primus Omnifuel, so that you can pick up. We were cooking on white gas, refined petrol in effect, but we could have gone on to bottle gas or paraffin or just about anything. That's what we had as our main system, but we did actually have the wonderful M kettle, wood burning kettle, just because we'd actually done quite a number of tours where we tried to tour just using wood with the bicycle, and we carried a Kelly kettle quite successfully. And at the very moment I was looking around for a lighter version of that, the good old M kettle came on the market. And that saved us a lot of fuel carrying, and it was good fun. We didn't go the whole hog with the bush buddy or the bush cooker, but morale. It's wonderful to get people looking at you as well. That's very, very nice.
That's another interesting question, really. How did the others on the campsite take your range of equipment that you obviously brought from Europe over? You've already mentioned the Pot Cozy and the effect that had on them, but was there anything else that took them by surprise as being either a good or a bad thing that you were taking with you?
To be honest, the thing that always gets the... And you would look for these once you knew it was going to happen. When you got out the folding plates in a communal kitchen, they got so many glances. It felt like a magician putting these things together. It got so many admiring glances. These are the folding plates that are virtually unavailable now. And we love them. We've got two, and they're holding together, but only just.
What about clothing, Esther, from a female point of view? Is there anything there that you learned to either improve on or I mean, New Zealand is obviously very big in merino wool.
Yeah, but I didn't actually have merino wool. That was Warren had got the proper kit for that, but I had just normal cycling clothing for women. But I've got various thicknesses for the tops and also various thicknesses and lengths for my shorts. I was carrying two or three shorts with me, cycling shorts, of various thicknesses and lengths. And certainly in the North Island, that was very good because it was so hot. I could actually strip down to almost dangerous levels there. But that was a bit of a surprise to actually learn how to actually travel in that heat. otherwise, I actually had, I mean, towards the end, I changed my shoes. I used to have specialized shoes, and they were good, but I changed them in the States to city shoes. Again, you know, being wide and comfortable. The shoes I had were actually mountain bike shoes. But yeah, so that was one of the points I learned. And Warren wants to add something as well.
Yeah, I just fundamentally, we when you read about cycle touring, most of the people will say dress normally and blend in. And we kind of made the decision straight away. We're used to cycling, looking like cyclists. And actually, in the two places we've been so far, I think probably through Europe, looking like a cyclist means that when you walk away from the bike, people come up to you, say, "Are those your bikes?" And then you get into probably 80% of the conversations we got were because we looked like cyclists. And that's not the standard thing to do, I think.
The move to America, did that involve packing the bikes up, or did you have bikes that you were picking up in each country?
Yeah, actually, thinking about that, transporting the bike is always a big problem for people that want to do a cycle tour. The kind of traditional way to do it is to go into the nearest bike shop and try and beg a cardboard box. But we kind of realized if you looked online, proper bike bags that maybe a couple of years ago would be £150, you can actually get them for £30. And at that point, they become almost disposable. And there you have a padded bag that you can hopefully use several times. So we kind of flew to New Zealand already, having got in touch with a youth hostel saying that we'll be arriving with these bags and we'll be back in 3 months. Can we store them with you? So we got two uses there. Then when we flew the bikes to LA, we got another use out of them there. And we had somebody in Boston at the very end where we could FedEx the bike bags across to. So we, you know, for £30 initial investment, we got several uses out of them.
My thanks once again to Warren and Esther for joining us in this interview. And of course, part two, which will be released shortly, covers their trip through America. Now, as they said in the interview there, if you want to look up more information about their trip, which they are currently doing, as I say, probably for the next 3 years or so, do Google the Sports Wool Diaries. And it's a complete compendium of their trip so far, pictures, their experiences, and some of the people they've met en route. So, thanks very much for joining me on this occasion. I'm Bob Cartwright, and you've been listening to The Outdoor Station. Don't forget to join us for part two next time. Bye for now.
This independent programme has been brought to you by The Outdoor Station, the exciting new way to see and hear free information about the outdoors world. Visit our website, theoutdoorstation.co.uk, for more information.